budget. Department of Human Services. So whoever, I guess we don't have names of who's testifying, so whoever. Okay, so. We're starting with continuing care? Okay, and we've got someone that's coming right back. Okay, we can wait. We still have a few senators that are coming right back, too. So. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care Services at the Department of Human Services. I'm here to present the recommendation for changes to the long-term care programs in Minnesota. These include nursing homes, home and community-based services, including waivers and grant funding that serve people who are elderly or who have disabilities and who use publicly funded programs. Proposing reductions to the long-term care programs is not something any of us prefers to do, likes to do. It's not desirable, but solving for a $6 billion.
Can you hold just one second?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coleman, could you tell us where in the book you are starting from so we can follow? If you wouldn't mind.
I was going to get to that, but I will be beginning on page 39 when I begun looking at the proposals in
Thank
detail.
You. Thank you, Senator Newman.
But solving for a $6.2 billion deficit is the challenge before all of us, and it requires us to consider a variety of options. Long-term care programs in Minnesota comprise about $3.3 billion in annual state and federal spending. It's about 28% of the human services budget. The majority of long-term care services are funded through medical assistance, and it's no secret that medical assistance spending is growing. The growth in our area is a result of two factors. The first is growth in the number of people using our programs, or caseload, as we refer to it. Medical assistance is an entitlement, and people who are eligible for MA long-term care services are entitled to these benefits. Federal health care reform requires a maintenance of effort, and you'll hear me reference that periodically through the presentation. So it makes it impermissible for us to change eligibility for MA in some cases until 2014. Makes it more difficult for us to limit the caseload growth. In fact, in the 2009 legislative session, changes in eligibility for nursing facilities and home and community-based services were adopted, changes that made people with fewer needs ineligible for medical assistance. But those changes must be delayed until 2014 now. There is a cost to this delay, and that is part of the budget package, and the Health Care Administration has incorporated that cost in their presentation. However, you will see several proposals in the package that target the rates that we pay for lower need people in our programs. These proposals target reductions to the rates paid for those lower needs, many of whom will become ineligible for medical assistance in 2014 when we are able to implement the nursing facility level of care. Also, the state is permitted under the maintenance of effort to limit the growth in new waiver allocations, and you'll see a proposal today. So limiting the number of people is one of the ways that we can manage the growth. The other way in which medical assistance spending increases is due to the increasing cost per person. People are living longer. Modern medicine is now able to save people who might have died in the past. Premature infants, people with traumatic brain injuries, etc., are all living longer and participating in our program. Secondly, costs go up because as people age, their needs tend to increase overall. So we're dealing with both the health and the long-term care needs of an aging population. And finally, we're seeing fewer people served in nursing homes, but more people being served in the community. As a result, the total spending in home and community-based services is going up, while spending for nursing facilities is flat or, in some cases, actually going down. It's not an easy task for any of us. These programs need to continue to exist to meet the needs of the people who cannot afford to pay for these programs on their own. For many who rely on long-term care services, they are critical. We are proud of our Minnesota's long-term care system and want to maintain our quality, but we know we have to take a collective approach to managing the costs so that they can continue to function as we want them to. So I'd like to move into the proposals themselves, and I'll direct you to page 39, which is the first proposal that I'll talk about. The first two proposals that I'm going to talk about are actually proposals that would continue funding reductions that we've used in previous years. On page 39, this proposal eliminates the 2009 1% acuity factor that is added to the developmental disability waiver allocation to help counties address the changing needs of the individuals in this program. This acuity factor from January 1, 2009 was delayed until July 1, 2011 by the 2010 legislature. Counties have adjusted their budgets to incorporate that, and this proposal recommends eliminating that 1 year 1% factor only.
Mr. Chair?
There is an ongoing 1% factor.
Senator Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you explain to us what the developmental disability waiver acuity factor is, what that actually is? There's a number of us that haven't been here before.
Certainly.
Mr. Coleman?
Mr. Chair, Senator. There is a factor that is used in the developmental disability waiver that is an annual 1% addition to the budgets that the counties get to manage the services for this waiver. It is intended to allow for the increased needs of the people that are already in the program. So it's factored into the forecast as additional funding to take care of the people that are already in the program. There is a pattern, a trend over many years that indicates that as people age in this program, their needs increase. And so this has been a piece of legislation in the past in the formula to allow for that growth.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So essentially, this is an inflation factor, for lack of a better term. I mean, it just kind of is growing without actually looking at the exact needs. Is that, am I understanding that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it is a type of inflator, certainly. But actually, as we've looked at the growth is actually, over time, a factor greater than this. When we designed the waiver and we looked at the factors that are causing pressure on the services for people in this waiver, our data actually shows that the acuity increase is more along the lines of 2 to 2.4% to try to manage more efficiently. The 1% factor was selected to apply to the acuity.
Thank you.
So let me just repeat it. So one-time elimination of the factor. In subsequent years, the 1% acuity factor will be applied to the waiver. Moving to page 40, this proposal suspends the funding for Community Services Development Grant Program for 2 years, or a portion of the funding, and prohibits the use of these funds for capital and renovation projects. Again, this is a continuation of a reduction that has been used in the current biennium. It reduces the amount of funding available by $3.6 million for each year of the biennium. It still leaves approximately $2.2 million per year in fiscal year 12 and 13, so we can continue to build the home and community-based structure throughout Minnesota. This has been a tool that has been used to help providers and help counties develop the services to meet people's needs outside of institutions. Again, this would restrict or this would eliminate for the next 2 years any construction funds. The service funds would still be available for the department to use to respond to an RFP. The next proposals would reduce what the state pays for services that people have who are, we categorize as in the lowest needs. And now I'm going to start getting into page 41. And this becomes a little more complicated to explain because there are a number of features to it. There's a variety of elements that we are proposing to reduce future expenditures in the elderly waiver and the alternative care program. And bear with me while I get a reference chart here. In the elderly waiver program, let me give you some scope. Let me give you some perspectives of how large the program is and what these proposals will impact. The elderly waiver program in 10 and 11, fiscal years 10 and 11, all funds spent about $617 million. The forecast for this program grows to about $666 million for the biennium. Similarly, the number of people served would grow from an average currently in the elderly waiver for fiscal year 11 of about 21,700, it would actually be reduced slightly over the next 2 years due to the interaction of some of these proposals. So in fiscal year 13, we would serve approximately 20,700. The alternative care program is a state-funded program, and it's meant for those individuals who do not quite qualify for medical assistance, but is designed to help people stay in their homes so they don't spend their resources more rapidly and then have to go on the medical assistance program. And that also will be impacted by these proposals. So just to try to give you a scope of current spending, forecasted spending for the elderly waiver and alternative care. There's, again, a variety of components to this. Individuals who are in this particular program, we're looking at those that have the lowest needs, and they are classified as case mix L. It means that a person has no behavioral or cognitive or clinical monitoring needs, needs help with only one non-critical activity of daily living, and this expands that definition. It changes the definition of a case mix L, that classification, so that an individual could have two dependencies of non-critical activities of daily living. So we're classifying more people at this lowest need. Those individuals would then, as part, so that's B1, or I'm sorry, A1. And it indicates on the page how many people that would affect. A2 indicates that we're recommending that we would lower the budget for these individuals, the community budget, from $2,200 per month to $1,750. So this group of individuals would have to make some choices, how they would spend that money differently with a lower budgeted amount. Customized living, I'll move on to B1. Customized living is what we refer to in Minnesota. It's mainly assisted living. We're more commonly known as assisted living. But we have customized living, and then we have 24-hour customized living. And so these are services that are available under the elderly waiver. And we are looking closely at this program to manage the growth. The customized living is a bundled service. It is provided by providers under a housing with services registration, and then a home care agency typically provides the services. So it's a very different arrangement than we have with our institutional providers. It's our more expensive product within elderly waiver. For example, about 35% of the individuals in the elderly waiver use customized living or 24-hour customized living. But they consume about 60% of the dollars. So it is the majority of how we're spending the money in elderly waiver when people move into these settings. So we're trying to manage both the expenditures and the growth in this service. Under B1, we are targeting individuals who, again, are at that lowest case mix category, the L, and again, trying to put more people into that category. And then the service rate limit, based upon the individual's level of need, would reduce that limit by 25%. Again, we're asking people with the lowest needs to look at how that money is being spent. We're asking them to work with providers to figure out how we can provide those services more economically, and we are reducing that service rate limit accordingly. Additionally, under B2, we're reducing the component rates for all people in the customized living bundled package. We're going in and looking at what we are paying for the components that make up the total rate. And on average, we're looking at reducing those component rates 10%. So, for example, we have, now let me explain a little bit about how the component rates work that develop the bundled rate. Each individual is assessed when they are moving into a customized living. And the provider and the county and the consumer all work together to assess their needs. And it may suggest a certain number of hours of care. There's a component for meals. There's a component for socialization, for supervision. And there's kind of a checklist of assessment items. And then that translates into a cost. And then you add all of those costs up to come up with the bundled rate. So each of those components we will look at, and we will adjust those based upon what we think we can effectively do to reduce expenditures. Some may be maintained the way they are right now. Some may have a greater than a 10% rate. But on average reduction, it would be looking at those component rates and reducing those. I'll pause if there's any questions.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coleman. I'm looking at page 41, and I've just added up. It looks like the number of people that are affected under column A and column B, and I'm coming up with about 1,144 people. Am I looking at that correctly?
Mr. Coleman?
Let me look at my chart.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Yes, I see.
Bear with me, please.
And I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
No, no.
Regarding, but what I'm looking at is on page 41, it looks like in paragraph A, we've got 60 people that are affected. In A2, we've got 436 people affected. B1, 233 individuals affected. B2, 415 people affected. And I added that up, that's 1,144. So my question is, we are looking at a savings of $26.138 million in the next biennium, and that will affect 1,144 people. Am I correct in my reading of your information?
Mr. Coleman. Chair, Senator, I believe so.
Okay. And could you tell me then, in the current biennium, I believe you indicated that we've got $617 million that is being spent on this program. How many people are involved in this program?
Mr. Coleman, staff has asked if there are additional people on the next page that might be included in that person count.
Mr. Chair, yes, there are other individuals that are impacted, and not to confuse the committee, but there are impacts on other programs too as we look at the collective long-term care system.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman.
Yes. I apologize. I didn't see the other individuals on the other side, but what I'm trying to get at here, I guess, is you had indicated that this program in the current biennium, I believe it's $617 million, and it is a program that is designed to assist people to stay in their homes rather than go into nursing homes, which everybody agrees is much more expensive. Is there any way that you can articulate for me the savings that we are realizing by spending the $617 million?
Mr. Chair, Senator, first let me address the question that I wasn't able to find here. There are, in fiscal year 12, about 21,300 people on the elderly waiver program. Fiscal year 13, there'll be about 20,700. So that gives you a scope of the number of people we're impacting with this particular proposal and the universe of people in the elderly waiver. So I hope that answered your earlier question. The savings that, if I can interpret your question, the savings that we are experiencing from having this program as opposed to institutional care, nursing facility care, I don't have an actual number of what we would be saving if these individuals would be in nursing facilities, but we could calculate that for you. In no way do I want the committee to interpret that we don't value the elderly waiver program or see the purpose and the necessity to maintain the program.
Thank you. And I think Senator Lurie had a question, and then we'll.
I did. Chair and Mr. Coleman, I don't think that these are discrete sets of individuals in every case, and you can't just add up the numbers. I mean, for instance, A1's 60 people, I think, would be a subset of the 436 people in A2. You can't just, they're not discrete sets. I mean, so if we want to talk about this, we're going to, you know, you can't just add up all of the people because they're served in multiple places. A1 puts more people into case mix L, A2, then reduces the rates for people in case mix L. So A1 would be a subset of A2, I think. I mean, and I'm trying to read B1 and B2. I think they might be similarly situated. So you can't just add up the number of people and say there's 1,100 people is out in my
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator Coleman. Lurie, I think that's correct, that there is overlap with some of the proposals or some of the components in here, that although we may be reducing or changing the definition of a case mix level, the rate reduction would also apply to some of those same individuals depending upon their assessment.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. Mr. Coleman, in B2, you're talking about the 24-hour customized living services and a rate reduction. But one of your bullet points is 415 people will enter nursing facilities from housing facilities as a result of this reduction. Could you tell us how that's going to save us money?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that doesn't save us money for those individuals, but we have to account for the fact that some people will not be served in a housing with services setting and may enter a nursing facility because that's the entitlement, and so we offset that cost to the overall proposal. So that is factored into the collective savings to the page.
Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, I was actually just wanting to follow up on what Senator Newman and Senator Hoffman were saying. So with that 415 people, this $26 million in savings, is that $26 million after those 400 people are lost into nursing homes? That's the net savings?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Coleman. Senator, that's correct.
Thank you. Senator Newman, did you have a question as well? Thank you. Mr. Coleman, please. Proceed.
Okay. Let's move to B3. 24-hour customized living is an intensive high-cost service that provides support to those individuals with the highest needs. Again, this proposal increases the criteria that a person must meet in order to be eligible for this particular service. Currently, the criteria include a dependency in at least two ADLs, bathing, dressing, grooming, walking, eating, for examples, plus a need for medication management and at least 50 hours of service per month. This proposal increases that criteria from two ADLs to three ADLs. The strategy ensures that this service, again, is directed to those individuals with the highest needs. Please note that although an individual may be deemed no longer eligible for 24-hour customized living, the individual can still be eligible for customized living services or regular customized living services. So it changes the criteria, the buckets, if you will, of who is served in this highest need category. B4, again, references the standardized rate setting methodology that I described earlier. We have implemented that in 2010 throughout the state. It is a consistent rate tool that must be used for anyone entering a customized living and matching the payment to the needs of the individual. While we have been implementing that, we've looked at the data, we've been examining the data, of the individuals that are in this program, and it suggests that there is further savings to be had by auditing the rate setting tool to achieve greater integrity to the program. For example, we want to make sure that as the individuals are assessed and the service bundle is developed, that those services that an individual are eligible for through the Medicare program are not included in what we're paying for, and that the beneficiary actually get their services, a nurse visit, for example, if they're eligible through Medicare rather than through a bundled rate. So this does propose that we would audit the tools and save at least 1% of what we are spending on this customized living package. Okay, moving on, page 44. you'll begin to see a theme here as we're really looking at individuals with the lowest needs in our long-term care system and asking the consumers, the providers, and our partners to help us manage services more effectively for the low-need individuals. This this proposal looks at individuals who are in nursing facilities. And nursing facilities have a different acuity system. It's called RUGs, Resource Utilization Groups. We didn't invent it. It's a federal program that we adopted to determine the acuity classification for our nursing facility individuals in Minnesota. Again, for some background, the 2009 level of care changes that we have to delay through the maintenance of effort would result in many of these individuals no longer being eligible for nursing home care. So this is kind of a bridge to 2014 when many of these individuals will no longer be served in this program. What we are proposing is to reduce that PA1 classification 25% of the operating rate for each nursing facility throughout Minnesota. This will create or encourage diverting more independent elderly to community settings and not have them receive their services in a nursing facility. Again, targeting the lowest need people in our system as a way to continue to evolve our long-term care programs.
This is doing the rural permits.
Let me give you some facts about nursing facilities, as I've been asked to do. All funds for the nursing facility, nursing facilities in Minnesota, in our current biennial budget, is about $1.63 billion. Forecast is projected to go down slightly to about $1.58 billion for this program. And that is driven primarily by lower utilization. As the long-term care system continues to evolve, we're seeing people entering and leaving more quickly, and therefore the caseload for nursing facility expenditures is actually flat or slightly declining. And that's driven a lot by policy as we develop alternatives, and a lot by consumer choice, as people are finding alternative ways to stay in their homes or find other congregate settings that meet their needs. But in, you know, editorial comment, but we have no design to eliminate nursing facilities. They still serve a useful purpose in our long-term care spectrum.
Mr. Coleman, excuse me one second. Senator Sharon.
Yes. Can I draw the conclusion, or would this be inaccurate, that this reduction that's forecasted from 1.63 billion to 1.58 would reflect the savings that's coming to the system as a result of our efforts to move to more community-based or in-home services? Some questions have been, I've been watching for this, looking for where are we going to see some of these long-term care numbers go down because of our initiatives to build up the community-based services. Is it fair to say that this is a place that we're seeing some positive impact from our earlier policies?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that's correct. I think we've seen a fairly consistent, small but consistent trend downward in our nursing facility expenditures. The nursing facilities are being impacted by a number of factors. One More of the people entering nursing facilities are looking for a short stay, and oftentimes Medicare is the payer that the individual can access as a Medicare beneficiary for their skilled nursing, and then they return home. So we're seeing shorter stays, and then some people never entering nursing homes because of the availability of alternatives in their own home or in other settings. So, yes, we have to look at this collectively across all of our elderly programs to see what the net result is. But we would expect nursing facilities to decline somewhat, although that's countered by increased acuity, too, as we're serving the more complex people in nursing facilities. Okay, turning to page 46. Well, now we're turning to the disability waivers, programs that are serving people under the age of 65 in Minnesota. And we are proposing to reduce some congregate living rates in those programs. Again, we're targeting low-need individuals, and the theme is we can't implement nursing facility level of care for these individuals either. So as we're doing that, we're looking at how we can sustain our home and community-based system by, again, making sure that those individuals with the highest needs get the greatest level of support. Congregate living in the disability waivers is defined as foster care settings where the license holder does not live with the individuals who are receiving services. So that's corporate foster care. Also, customized living or assisted living is available for individuals in the disability waivers also. Let me make a distinction on the waivers. So we have a full and complete picture here. The waivers pay for services. They do not pay for housing. Housing is paid either by the individual or a state housing fund or group residential housing, GRH, which many of you, I'm sure, have heard before. So the waivers is just looking at services, and that's a federal definition. Let me again give you some scope on the disability waivers. So you have that for a reference. On the DD, Developmental Disability, and the CADI, the Community Alternative for Individuals with Disabilities, all funds we in current biennial budget 2010 and 11, we spend about $2.9 billion, so that's federal state, 2.9. The forecast suggests that we're going to spend $3.4 billion in the 12-13 budget. So significant growth in the forecast. And I'll reference back to that with a couple of the different pages. So certainly that is a significant factor as we've looked at the disability waivers and how can we manage them more effectively. Additionally, let me give you some numbers on the number of individuals in these programs. In fiscal year 11, right now, on any given month, we serve about 31,000 individuals in the developmental disability and the community alternative for individuals with disabilities. It's about 31,000 persons monthly. That is projected in the forecast to move to 33,265 in fiscal year 12, and then another growth in fiscal year 13 to just under 35,000. So significantly more individuals are forecasted to enter this program. Reducing these congregate living rates would impact about 3,600 of those people. And trying to give you some scope. Again, we see most of the money being spent in these waivers on these kinds of settings. Some further data. About 30% of the people on the CADI program, about 30% of the individuals are living in congregate settings and they're receiving two-thirds of the funding. That's the proportion. On the development to disability side, about 55% of the individuals live in these congregate settings and they receive about 75% of the funding. So these are our more expensive settings to serve people in. There will be a significant impact upon the system with this proposal. We're not trying to deny that. But it is consistent with our direction that we're trying to go in finding ways to serve people in ways other than these congregate settings. I'll pause.
Senator Newman and then Senator Lori have questions. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coleman, looks like 31,000 individuals in any given month in the year 2011 going up to a forecast of 35,000 individuals in 2013. Can you tell me what is driving that increase?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Senator. There are individuals who, if allowed, would enter these waiver programs. We currently have enrollment restrictions in law that limit the number of people that can enter these particular waivers. So that's slowing the growth. Now, at the end of this fiscal year, those limits expire. And so the forecast anticipates that all of those individuals who are waiting to enter the waivers would enroll if there were no restrictions.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are the restrictions that you are referring to that are about to expire, are those federal restrictions or state restrictions?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Senator, those are state restrictions. We're allowed under our waivers to manage the number of people who enter our waivers. So that's a legislative decision to allow a certain specific number of people into our disability waivers.
Mr. Coleman, before you proceed, earlier you mentioned that the current level of spending is $2.9 billion, forecasted $3.4 billion. I take it that is the entire funds. Could you tell us the general fund portion of those numbers?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. The state share for our current biennial budget is $1.1 billion for the 2 years. Now, that's skewed a bit because of enhanced federal match. So I just want to comment on that. The forecasted spending for fiscal years 12 and 13 is $1.7 billion. So that returns us to about the 50-50 match.
And so, Mr. Coleman, and that just to help me remember and maybe for others, that in current biennium we receive some federal monies that we applied to this area so that our normally obligated matching portion was actually picked up by a federal government supplementary fund, which tends to look at that growth being maybe a little bit more dramatic than it otherwise would be.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
And then just to clarify, Mr. Coleman, the proposals that the governor is making to reduce the savings of $12.1 million over the biennium, that is to the forecasted, that's the general fund portion. Is it safe to assume that there's another $12 million that will be reduced in spending from the federal matching part so that the total effect in this area would be $24 million roughly? Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, that would be correct.
Thank you. Senator Lori, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nino.
Thank you. Going back to Senator Newman's question about the term was restrictions, I'm assuming it's eligibility. Parameters where those are dropping off, and that's what's driving some of that increase in the forecast. I've served on this committee before, but wasn't here last year. Were those restrictions put in the last budget as an attempt to save money, or why is it that those are changing? Was that a one-time adjustment because of last year's budget problems, or could you give us some history on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, certainly the enrollment restrictions is to try to manage the scope and the cost of the program. Let me quickly try to find, because we'll get to it in a little bit. There is a chart in here, in your book, that shows some history on the waiver restriction enrollment. If you turn to page 48, we will be recommending continuing some enrollment restrictions to this program. On page 48, you'll see the history of how we have managed the number of individuals coming into the disability waiver programs, and then the recommendation for 12 and 13 in that particular feature. So this is not a new strategy to try to manage the cost of the program. But it kind of skews the numbers, because we have to forecast by what's in law, and so we have to project that everyone would enroll if given that opportunity, and so it kind of accentuates the forecast, but then we take the savings by continuing or recommending continuing some enrollment limits.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, let me regain where I am here. On the congregate living rates, page 46, again, we are asking counties and providers and consumers to take a look at the needs of the lowest of our individuals in these waivers and adjust their spending practices for these individuals. It's for these groups, it'll be a little more challenging. And so the budget was constructed as kind of a two-step process. In fiscal year 12, we would reduce the cost by 10%. We would ask those impacted to look at their spending patterns by 10%, and then in 13, an additional 15%. That's a little bit different than what we did with the low-need nursing facility, low-need cut reduction, because these individuals have fewer options to consider. We want to make sure that the counties, case managers, and individuals and providers have a little more time to adjust their spending patterns. Okay, now we'll move into how do we manage the individuals coming into the programs, the enrollment limits. And page 48, we get into our recommendations on that. I won't repeat the numbers, actually the growth in the programs we've already discussed, but this is a proposal that would limit the growth of the developmental disability waiver, the CADI, community alternative waiver, and the traumatic brain injury waiver. It would limit the new allocations on a monthly basis as we work with we work with either waiting lists or priorities that are established by the counties. These are significant restrictions. I don't want to minimize that this really does challenge the system to prioritize those with the highest needs. Let me comment, though, that it doesn't mean that the individuals who are not in the waiver receive no services. They are still eligible for other home care, PCA, et cetera. So it's not as if you get all or you get none. But certainly the waiver has a broader array of options for individuals who are able to enter the program.
Mr. Coleman, just to that general point, is it, and maybe I'm seeing this incompletely, but is the cost to care for individuals or to help care for individuals through a waiver program versus a PCA program? You mentioned that because there are restrictions in the waivers doesn't mean people are not getting help, but they're getting it through some other form. Is it more costly to serve the needs of people through these waiver programs, or is it more costly through the other programs, the PCA programs?
Mr. Chair, the waivers are significantly more costly than the home care PCA programs. If it was the inverse, we'd probably be making some other decisions. So the PCA program is really one of our lower cost programs of helping people stay out of institutions.
And Mr. Coleman, I don't want to get you too far afield from the budget questions, but can you talk a little bit about these waiver structures and why they were developed a little bit, and just you know, what's the rationale to do what we're doing? If we're trying to meet needs in an economically efficient way, this would seem to be a. Oftentimes, we try to find lower cost models, such as moving from nursing care to home care and so forth. This seems to be a model that is going the other way. Just curious about the history of that.
Mr. Chair, let me try to recount some history, and if I miss some significant points, I'm going to ask staff to help me out. This population also at one time lived in institutions. Years ago, we had a whole array of state institutions and intermediate care facilities for, at that time it was called mental retardation, we call it developmental disability now. Many of these individuals on the CADI program would have lived in nursing homes. So this is a population that at one time was institutionalized. Minnesota actually was one of the pioneers 20, 30 years ago. I'm losing track of time here a little bit as I age, but decided that was not the best way to serve people and began closing state institutions and intermediate care facilities, nursing facilities, and moving to a lower cost model. For this population, though, we really don't have much of an institutional sector any longer. We're down to less than 2,000 ICF DD beds in the system. Most people are being served in these community-based models. So the perspective of the savings kind of evaporates because we don't have the same comparisons like we have with the elderly as we shrink the nursing facility side. But if we went back in time and projected what would it have cost to continue to serve people in state institutions, to continue to serve people in ICFMRs, the cost would be enormous. We have to demonstrate to the federal government in order to maintain our waiver that this is less expensive than an institutional service. It's called a waiver because the individuals are really only entitled to an institutional level of care. We need to seek permission, and we have to seek permission every 5 years to renew our waiver to get permission to serve people outside of institutions, because the waiver is not the entitlement. It's the institutional care. So we, again, just to repeat myself, we kind of lose that perspective of how much are we saving, because we're not. That's not the way the services are designed today.
And Mr. Coleman, is this essentially the standard or the direction that most states are going? Are we in the mainstream of what other states are doing as we're looking at serving people with these kinds of concerns or needs? Are we part of a general trend?
Mr. Chair, it is the prime focus of the federal government to encourage, incent, help states move in this direction. It is driven some by cost, a lot by consumer preferences. A lot by how can we have a higher quality of life for individuals who have disabilities. The federal government is actively encouraging states. We are among the leaders. We are one of the states that other states look to how were you able to get that job done. and something that I think Minnesota should be proud of, that we are serving people in the community, in all of our neighborhoods, in all of our communities, and continuing to integrate these individuals. Now, we still have more work to be done, and you'll hear a little bit later in my presentation a very small piece on employment for people with disabilities, because that's kind of our next challenge, our next opportunity as we work with individuals with disabilities. So the waiver enrollment limits is one of the tools that we have available through our federal waiver to manage the expenditures in these programs. Moving to page 50, which is another way of managing the future growth. Again, the elderly waiver is a valuable program for us. We value it highly as an alternative to nursing home placement. But again, it's growing, and it's going to continue to grow as we have the demographic pressures of an aging population. At one point in time, the decision was made to link the elderly waiver caps with nursing facility expenditures and to manage those together. So if nursing facility rates went up, the elderly waiver caps would go up. This proposal is recommending that we separate that linkage and that we make any increase in the elderly waiver caps a legislative decision, a purposeful decision that we come and examine. Should we provide some increase to the caps that we're able to pay for elderly waiver and not be automatic? It has a small savings, as you can see, in the near term, but the savings grow over time.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Coleman, what is the, if you had to pick an average, and I don't know if you keep track of averages, average cost for nursing home versus elderly waiver? I'm just curious, I mean, how much when we're increasing nursing home rates, how much elderly waiver, where are they right now in terms of percentage of one of the other?
Mr. Coleman?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't have that at my disposal. We'll look it up for you. Let's pause for a second. Elderly waiver. 36. Okay, let me try to answer that. The average cost in nursing facility is $136 per day. The average elderly waiver cost, we'll have to do some math here, is $1,166 per month, because we do it differently. So 136 times an average of 30-day month, you're looking at, but in the neighborhood of $4,000 per month. Versus 1166.
So then, Mr. Senator Chairman, Marty, if the difference is about 1,200 to 4,000 ballpark per month, I can see how, if you don't keep the elderly waiver up when we deal with nursing facility rates, I can see how it grows exponentially, the savings. But I'm wondering if, at the same time, we're pushing more people in nursing homes here. I mean, you were talking appropriately about how we can be proud. We as a state have done better than other states in keeping people out of nursing facilities. Every one of these recommendations so far is pushing more people into them, and maybe not as many being pushed in as the savings. But is this, when that savings grows under this separation of the two rates, are we going to see more people pushed into nursing homes as a result?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that would not be our intent. Certainly, again, I'll repeat, we value the elderly waiver program. We're just suggesting that it be a distinct decision to examine the elderly waiver program, look at the adequacy of the rates, and increase them if they are a barrier to people entering that program. Part of the reason that the increase occurs is nursing homes have, in law, some features that will increase their rates if they're not continuously suspended. But if those are applied to the way we pay nursing facilities, it would drive the cost in this automatically, and we're just suggesting that it be a separate decision. We have limited tools to manage the elderly waiver, similar to the other disability waivers. I will, at some risk, but I'll suggest that we've avoided another tool by design, and that is to put an enrollment restriction on elderly waiver. We've examined that, similar to what we've done with the disability waivers. And we've taken a different approach to managing the elderly waiver with some of the rate components to avoid putting a restriction on the number of elderly that can enter the waiver.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Coleman. Have you made any assumptions? So the legislature would need to make an explicit decision to add something to the elderly waiver. Have you made any assumptions about whether we would do that, or is it, or are you assuming in these savings that, that there would not be any action like that from the legislature?
Mr. Coleman. Chair, Senator, we have not tried to predict what the legislature will do in the future. So we've not factored anything into it.
So this is just leaving it flat.
Correct.
Out into the future.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, moving on, page 51. These are rate reductions. There is no other way to describe them. They are taking what we are paying for services currently, the rates that we are paying for the services, and reducing them. There are some distinctions, though, that I would want to make. So that we have some clarity around these rate reductions. Across our home and community-based sector, both aging and disability sectors, we are recommending a 4.5% rate reduction for those services and to our grants. We are also recommending a 2% rate reduction to our nursing facilities. But as you'll see in a subsequent page, that's not the only reduction that is being recommended to nursing facilities. So, you have to look at the complete package. Again, disclosure, we are asking for some administrative funding. We acknowledge that these kinds of rate reductions are going to be quite challenging to providers and the consumers that they serve. And we have an obligation to assure access to our medical assistance consumers that services will be available throughout Minnesota. So we are asking for some funds to secure an outside contractor, not have the department do it, but have an independent contractor monitor and evaluate the long-term care system and share with us where, if any, we develop access problems due to providers going out of business or downsizing or not being able to meet the needs of people in their communities. It's one of the few administrative requests that we've made, but we are we are concerned about this level of reduction to our provider network.
And Mr. Coleman, I'm looking at page 52 that it seems to be a breakout of this proposal, and you mentioned hiring an outside contractor. Where is the cost for that identified in your table here on page 52?
Mr. Chair, that would be almost to the bottom of the page. Admin costs, $200. And then the federal match, which reduces that somewhat.
And you're saying federal match, meaning?
We get, Mr. Chair, we get federal money that matches what the state is paying for that activity, and so it offsets part of the cost of that administrative cost.
So part of the federal program is to provide funds, matching funds for consulting on these issues, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, for administrative costs, yes. It's a different rate of match than direct service rates, but yes, the Medicaid program does help us with that.
Okay. Senator Hall.
Chair and Mr. Coleman, you said that there was a 2% reduction in nursing home facility rates, and you said there were other factors. Putting all those other factors together, what do you think would be the reduction in a percentage? Do you have that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the calculation that impact nursing facilities that you're asking about would we estimate to be on average about 6%.
Okay.
But let me caution, that is not applied equally to each and every facility. As we get into some of the other component proposals, you'll understand that, you know, some facilities will be impacted quite a bit less, some will be impacted quite a bit more. Yeah. So it's not a straight 6% reduction to all nursing facilities.
Mr. Coleman,
let me just also qualify that the 2% is on the operating rate portion of what we pay nursing facilities.
Mr. Coleman, are you referring in your comments just now to the effect of the surcharge increases?
Mr. Chair, no. That's not what I'm referring to.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coleman, some reductions of this sort might be easily defensible if there were other reforms, regulatory reforms or such, that would ease up on I guess, for lack of a better term, overhead costs for providers. Can you point to anywhere in the governor's proposal where some of that exists?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't believe there's anything in our package that provides regulatory relief to these settings.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I could be corrected.
And it's not necessarily regulatory, but some sort of reforms that affords flexibility or something in that global category there with this reduction, we're providing pressure. Is there anywhere we're providing relief?
Mr. Coleman. And
Mr. Chair, Senator Nino, I'm Bob Hild from the
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. Bob.
Bob Hild, Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division. The nursing facility 2% rate reduction is accompanied with the proposal that the compensation plan requirements that have been imposed since 1998 be relieved. For the home and community-based providers, they received a rate reduction a year or two ago and were given relief from those requirements, and so this proposal will include relief for the nursing homes from those same requirements. What that means is that they will be able to look at wages and benefits as part of where they may be able to get savings. They would not be able to do that without that relief.
Thank you.
Let me clarify about relief to the provider sector. We have a number of ongoing initiatives that I would put in the category of reform. that aren't new to this budget, but will provide some administrative relief to providers. Let me give you an example. Currently, a provider who is doing business in multiple counties has to negotiate contracts with each one of those counties. They have to enroll as a provider and negotiate contracts and satisfy all of that administrative requirement. We have a reform initiative that was passed a couple years ago called PEPSI, Provider Enrollment and Provider Standards, that the state will assume responsibility to enroll all providers so that they don't have to go to each county and enroll. We will establish the standards and re-enroll them or re-validate that they are eligible to continue as a provider on an annual basis. Counties won't have to do that. So there is some shifting, and some of it is using technology that we can share information more easily today than when these programs were designed as a county-managed program 20 years ago. So we're trying to simplify administratively for these businesses in a number of ways. But it's not part of this package because it's work that already was presented, legislated, and being developed to roll out in the next number of months. Similarly, we've got other administrative functions, assessment tools. You'll hear about MIN choices sometime during the session, and that is where we are developing a single tool that will replace four current assessment tools so that the individual who's doing the assessment and the individual consumer only has to use one tool and go through it once. So we have other administrative reform efforts underway, but to clarify, they're not part of this budget because they've already been launched. I hope that's helpful. Mr. Chair, moving on to page 53. This is what I was referring to when I talked about there are other components that we are impacting nursing facilities that you have to look at in concert with the 2% cut. So this is a series of non-rate payments. So these are payments that are not in their rates, but is still revenue that nursing facilities would not receive or would be reduced by these recommendations. And there's a series of them. We would eliminate any new plan closure rate adjustments and new single bed incentives. We currently have programs that do provide an incentive, a payment, if you will, to nursing facilities if they close a bed. And then that gets rolled into their rates, and we pay that out into the future. It's been a very useful tool to help downsize the industry. Similarly, the single bed incentive to encourage facilities to create rooms where only one individual are living in. And we've been paying them to do that. Well, we're not taking those away from what they're already getting paid. Those decisions that have already been made, we will continue to honor. But any additional plan closure rate adjustments would be eliminated with this proposal. We have closed a lot of beds in Minnesota, as you know. We continue to decline in the number of beds per thousand and the utilization. We would anticipate there would still be some closures, but it may slow the number of beds that are taken out of the system because of the lack of availability of this payment.
Mr. Coleman, a couple of questions. First, what is the total general fund spending in this non-rate payment area and forecasted spending? And I assume there's some federal monies involved as well, but first just tell us what the general fund budget that we currently have and what the forecasted amount is that these are being applied to, these changes.
Okay, Mr. Chair, again, this is all included in the nursing facility payments, the larger component that I included earlier. The plan closure payments currently in 2010 is $10 million.
Is, Bob, is that state and federal? Is that state, $10 million state and federal?
Yes. Okay, so $10 million state and federal expenditures. The single bed incentive is $4.7 million. So those payments would continue. But we wouldn't be adding to those payments in the future.
And Mr. Coleman, just maybe I'm the only one that is confused about this, but why do we need to have an incentive to eliminate beds? And I'm assuming my take is from that really is a term of art that may mean more than just a physical object that we identify as a bed. But could you explain to the committee a little bit of what the dynamic is here and why are we focused on beds? It would seem to me, I think from someone who just flew in from another planet, they'd say, beds, who cares? You know, have as many as you want. What's the problem? But what's going on here with this?
Mr. Chair, I'll, again, try to recount some history here and kind of the way we do business sometimes in Minnesota. We view nursing facilities as kind of our partners in care. They're delivering the services to our families, our friends, our neighbors, and we want them to be successful. But we also wanted to shrink that sector and encourage the development of the alternatives. So that was a purposeful decision. But we recognize that nursing facilities have obligations. And if they take beds out of service, there's a cost to that. There are fixed costs, for example, that they can't just eliminate just because they have 80 consumers rather than 100. So the plan closure rate adjustment is trying to help them meet those fixed cost obligations and still be able to remain in business, that it's not an all or nothing component. Additionally, it does create savings. Paying for facilities to take, again, our more expensive service out of offline and serve people in other settings does create some savings. So it was kind of a collaborative approach between the state and the facilities to say, we'll help you if you voluntarily choose to downsize. It also tried to take advantage of some of the trends that consumers have been expressing preferences to be served in other settings. And so how can the state participate in that continued readjustment, rebalancing is what most people call it, of our long-term care system. It's not something we had to do. We could have just simply said, we'll let the market prevail. And if somebody can't pay their bills, they'll close and we'll have to relocate residents who are currently in their in those facilities. So it was trying to take an approach that looked at what are the business needs of the facility, what's in the best interest of the consumers who are living there, the workers who are employed there, and how can we do it in a more planful way. There are obligations from the provider sector to receive the plan closure rate adjustment. They have to comply with a planful process in order to get the payment. But that's kind of the origin, recognizing that it is going to downsize. How can we do it together?
Thank you.
Okay, so that's the plan closure in the single bed. We've also had a program in Minnesota that's encouraged short stay utilization of nursing facilities that has paid an enhanced rate for individuals the first 30 days in a facility. This page also recommends that we reduce that 20% add-on. We reduce that to 10% add-on. Currently, we are spending about $4.6 million as an enhanced rate, so we would reduce that. The next component involves bed holds. When a facility has a certain occupancy threshold, currently 93%, we will pay them if someone is out of the facility, in the hospital, at home on a therapeutic leave, for example, we will pay them 60% of their rate to ensure that the individual's bed is available when they return. This proposal reduces that rate to 30% payment of the rate, and it increases the threshold. It says we're going to pay it in circumstances where you are 96% occupied. We do know that that will take some revenue from facilities, but again, as I explained earlier, not all facilities are impacted similarly. Currently, only about 50% of the facilities in the state qualify at the 93% occupancy level to receive a bed hold payment. So it won't have any impact on about half of the facilities. And another 100 facilities will not be eligible when we raise the threshold to 96%. Let's see what we're also proposing that we reduce what the state is paying for a single room for a medical assistance participant, where we are paying for it on the basis of medical necessity. We currently pay nursing facilities an additional 11.5% above and beyond the established rate. And this recommendation is to reduce that payment to 5.5%. We think it's still important to recognize that individuals in our public programs may, by medical necessity, require a single room, and we want to continue paying for it, but we'll pay for it at a lower rate.
Thank you. Mr. Coleman, I appreciate your comments here, and I think we're at the ready to turn the page, but we're also looking at the timing here, and what I'd like to do is try to wrap this up without getting into the surcharges. Perhaps we can take that up on Monday. Okay. Before we close today, a question that I apologize, you may have made these comments in your introductory remarks to the committee, and I had another engagement that I was late getting here from, so I apologize. But the area that you are responsible for, the continuing care administration, seems to be a significant chunk of the total health and human services budget. Could you tell us, in all the areas that you are overseeing, what is the total general fund dollars that are administered in your area, as well as the all funds dollars?
The long-term care programs that we are administering are about $3.3 billion annually, all funds.
I'm sorry, I missed that. You said
about
all funds?
$3.3 billion annually in state and federal funds for long-term care.
And is the general fund portion roughly half of that? Is that?
Mr. Chair, correct.
So in all the areas that you're involved with, it's about $3.3 billion, half of which is roughly federal dollars. Has the administration or your department contemplated, or are you actively seeking additional relief from federal government program requirements as we look at how these funds are to be managed? Is that something that is being done currently or contemplated to be done I think one of the questions that I'm certainly wrestling with is all the things that we do, and so much of it has federal tie-in that in some cases may make it more difficult to innovate or to try something new. Is this an area that you're exploring or that the administration is interested in?
Mr. Chair, we're in continuous conversation with the federal government to try to provide us as much flexibility as possible. Earlier, I commented about the legislation that was passed in 2009 where the state decided to increase the nursing facility level of care so we could target our programs to those individuals with the greatest needs. The federal decisions along the way since 2009 have required us to not implement that eligibility change and maintain our effort. It wasn't something that we wanted to hear, but it's been the answer that we have continuously received. And that is why some of these other reductions are before us that otherwise would have been taken care of with the nursing facility level of care criteria. We're also looking at other strategies. I suspect we'll be back at some point in time to talk about Money Follows the Person, which is a new grant that we applied for earlier this year that we have now been awarded to help in a different way individuals who are living in institutions return to the community. And that just was announced earlier this week. We have not received any further information about the terms and conditions of what that grant award requires, but we're actually quite excited that we will have another tool to help us, again, move from an institutional-based system to a community-based system. So we're looking for those opportunities to help us with greater flexibility.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Coleman, going back to the very beginning portion of your presentation, I had written a note down that I wanted to come back to, and please pardon me if I get it wrong, but I think I heard you say that we cannot change eligibility requirements for MA nursing home now, but that we can in 2014. Did I get that right?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Coleman,
that's correct.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Coleman, could you explain to me in a little bit more detail what that is all about, the change in the eligibility criteria?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Sander, the legislature enacted in 2009, I believe it is, different criteria by which an individual would be eligible for our medical assistance long-term care programs. It elevates the requirements for activities of daily living, for example. It defines what an individual needs to need help with in order to enter our long-term care system. It's not solely nursing homes, although that's what we refer to, nursing facility level of care. I'm going to go back to that is the entitlement. That's what an individual who qualifies by economics, by income and asset, that's what they are entitled to. The waiver, the home and community-based system, is linked to that. So if you're not entitled to the nursing facility level of care or that product, you're also not entitled to elderly waiver or disability waivers that we've talked about earlier. So we've already decided to raise the bar and target these medical assistance programs to those with greater needs. Now, we also, as part of that legislation, received an appropriation for what we call essential community supports. It would be a low-cost monthly payment to individuals with low needs to help them remain at home. That was an offset to the nursing facility level of care reform. We've not needed that money because we haven't been able to implement the nursing facility level of care. But when we are able to implement that, those individuals who will no longer be eligible for that level of care may be eligible for these other support dollars to help them remain independent. I don't know if I fully answered your question, but I'd be happy to get you a one-pager about nursing facility level care, that reform from 2009.
Thank you.
That may, actually, the committee may be interested in having that document.
Mr. Coleman, we'd appreciate that. I want to thank you for coming again, and I apologize for not getting quite through the whole presentation and also the health care administration as well. I believe we have got a floor session on Monday that may impinge a little bit on our committee meeting on Monday. I think we're planning, if that goes longer, that we may meet in the evening, but we have some bills that we want to take up. So the likelihood is that if that were to occur, we would take up testimony from you and from the Health Care Administration on Tuesday. And members, just for your purposes, we are going to meet on Monday. I'm not sure if we'll meet at our normal time or meet perhaps at in the evening if we go long in session. And just for planning purposes, we do have scheduled committee time available to us on Friday. I think for the next few weeks we probably will be taking advantage of that. I'm not telling you we will in every case, but we are likely to. We've got some flexibility of when we can meet. We're scheduled, I think, 8:30 to 11 or something, but we could adjust that a little bit, I think, depending on what other committees are doing. But just, I think we'll be meeting at least for a little while on Fridays as well as the additional times during the week. So thank you, Mr. Coleman, and thank you, members. We're adjourned.